who's going to speak about black hole evaporation and lukewarm gravity.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. I'm going to speak about this recent work that we did in collaboration with Aurélien Barreau and Thomas Skeletto and Jia-Yu Cao and Julien Crenn, all of them in France. And so we can go to slide number two. So the talk is basically going to have two parts. The first part is going to be basically a review of things that we already know, and the second part is going to be this new work itself. So I will start motivating the problem, and then I will very briefly introduce isolated horizons and how we use isolated horizons in loop quantum gravity to describe black holes, and then how, starting with this framework, we compute black hole entropy. That would be the first introductory part of the talk. Then I'll go to the second part, which would be about radiation, Hawking radiation, and in particular the possible quantum signals that we could observe in this Hawking radiation coming from the structure of black holes and black hole entropy in this loop quantum gravity framework. So we will look at three possible signals. One of them would be some emission lines in the spectrum of microscopic black holes in the Planck regime. The second one would have to do with the low energy emission on the last stages of black hole evaporation. And finally, we'll consider also peaks, radiation peaks in the larger mass regime. So we go to the next slide. We all know that quantum theories of gravity have a big lack of observable tests and observable things in general. So it's always interesting to try to look for observational signatures of coming from loop quantum gravity theory. And that's our main goal here. That's our So the kind of thing we want to look at here is black holes. And in particular, we want to consider microscopic black holes that could be created in high-energy particle collisions, or also primordial black holes. And why do we want to look at these kind of objects is because we know, and we have in loop quantum gravity, a very precise description of the spectrum of these black holes, in particular the area spectrum of their horizon, and also of the degeneracy associated to that spectrum, and therefore of the entropy of black holes. So our question is, like, since we know very well the details of these spectra, are there any particular effects that we should expect once we see these objects evaporating? So that's the question we want to ask. And if we find this kind of effect, if we find some signal in this radiation spectra from these black holes, is that signal strong enough or distinct enough so that we can use it to differentiate loop quantum gravity from other candidate theories in a hypothetical experiment? So that's the second question we'll try to ask, and we're going to try to argue that the answer to both these questions is yes. So we go to next slide. So isolated horizons, what are they? They are basically a definition of horizon that tries to cure the problems that some other previous definitions of black holes had, in particular event horizons, which basically need to know the whole history of space-time in order to be defined. So isolated horizons are defined locally. So they are basically defined in terms of the intrinsic geometry of the horizon only, and they don't require to know the whole history of space-time, and they don't pose any restrictions on the surrounding space-time either. So they basically don't, we have this little picture here, so we know that there is this gray region with the delta, where we have the isolated horizon, but the definition of this isolated horizon doesn't require that in the past the horizon was stationary all the time. So we have this previous region where there was some radiation coming into the horizon. So, it is a local definition in the sense that we just care about the region of spacetime in which the horizon is going to be isolated, and we define it that way. And in particular for this world, we're going to restrict to the non-rotating case, so we're going to be talking about non-rotating isolated horizons. So a very sketchy definition of what an isolated horizon is basically a null hypersurface in which we have a preferred foliation, and this hypersurface has the topology of a two-sphere cross R. And then this null hypersurface has a null normal, and we require that this null normal has a vanishing expansion. So this basically is the main condition that captures the idea of a horizon. We also impose some additional normalization conditions, and then there are some other things coming in definition, like field equations hold at the horizon, and there are some mild energy conditions imposed too. But the main condition we are going to be using for the description of black holes comes down to this formula we have down here, which appears when we express all these conditions in terms of connection variables. We can derive that formula, and it basically relates the curvature of the connection intrinsic to the horizon, which is going to be in this framework we're using a U1 connection, because there is we're doing a gauge fixing on the horizon. It relates that curvature of the connection with the triad field on the bulk pulled back to the horizon. So that is what this equation is giving us. And we see, there's also this internal vector appearing there, which is the thing that is used to perform the gauge reduction, and we have the area of the horizon appearing there. All right, so we can go to the next slide. How do we use this horizon in order to describe a black hole in low quantum gravity? Well, the thing we do is consider a classical spacetime, and we put an isolated horizon inside this spacetime, then we quantize it. So we're going to have basically a spacetime with an inner boundary, and on this inner boundary, we're going to impose the isolated horizon boundary conditions, and that splits the phase space into a volume and a surface term, and we basically go ahead and quantize these two terms, these two phase spaces separately, so we arrive to a volume Hilbert space and a surface Hilbert space corresponding to the horizon, and after we have quantized, we have to impose the boundary conditions matching these two Hilbert spaces. And once we do all these, we arrive to this qualitative picture where we have horizon and the surrounding bulk. The bulk is as usual in low quantum gravity described by spin networks, but these spin networks are what we call open spin networks, and that means basically that some edges of the spin networks end at the horizon, so they are not connected to vertices of the graph, they just pierce the horizon. And on the other hand, the horizon is described by a Chern-Simon theory over these puncture spheres. So we are going to have little topological defects at those points where the spin network pierces the horizon, and these topological defects are going to capture the degrees of freedom of this Chern-Simon theory. So we can go to the next slide. Now, there are two ways we can look at the horizon. We can see the horizon as a surface in the bulk. And if we see this, basically, what we see is that the horizon is a surface that is pierced, as I was saying, by this spin network from the bulk. And as we know, and it's usual in low quantum gravity, these edges of the spin network will carry spin labels. And these spin labels contribute to endowing the horizon with a value of area. A value of area which is given by the first of these marked equations that we have here. So it's the area spectrum of a black hole horizon in low quantum gravity. So on the one hand, these horizon states, as seen from the bulk, are going to be characterized by a list of these J numbers, which are basically spins. But we also have additional labels associated to these punctures, and these additional labels are magnetic numbers, and they appear basically because we don't have intertwiners there at these ends of the edges of the spin network. So basically, this additional label appears because of the lack of gauge invariance there. And there, they just satisfy the usual magnetic relation thing between n's and j's in spin. So we have that they take values between minus j and j in integer sum. But we can also go ahead and look at the horizon from an intrinsic perspective. We can look at the intrinsic geometry of the horizon. And then what we have is a transimos theory, so the horizon is going to be described by flat connections, but they are flat except at the punctures where we have these topological defects. So basically, there is where we have the degrees of freedom for these states, and in order to construct a basis for geometrical states, we can consider holonomies of paths going around each individual puncture, and these punctures will be, or these holonomies will be characterized by these numbers that I'm putting here, these k numbers, which are integer modulo k numbers, where k is a constant that is called the level of the Chern-Simons theory. So what we have is that each of these punctures concentrates curvature distributionally, so we have these conical singularities of curvature concentrated at the punctures, and they are given by these angle deficits, basically the holonomies of these paths around them, which are given in terms of these A labels, as I was saying, we can see here. There is an additional condition we have here, which is given by the fact that we're working on a spherical horizon, and it's basically a quantum analogous of the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. It basically tells us that if we choose a path that goes around every puncture on the horizon, this is a contractible path on a sphere, because you can go, you know, the other side of the sphere and there's no puncture contained. So that should be a trivial holonomy. Therefore, we can extract this condition. Basically, the sum of all the A labels has to be zero modulo k. So we have these two separate Hilbert spaces with their corresponding labels and states, and now we have to impose the isolated horizon boundary conditions in order to match them. So what we do is take this previous equation that I was showing and promote it to a quantum operator equation, and then we have this equation down here. Now these are two operators acting on two different spaces, and in principle their spectra didn't have to match, but it turns out that they do. They can be matched. And that happens if we impose this relation we see down there between M labels and A labels. So basically, the boundary conditions give us a relationship between the M labels on the bulk Hilbert space, if you want, a relation between these and the A labels characterizing the intrinsic horizon geometry state. So this is the main boundary condition. So we can go to the next slide now. Now we've seen in the previous slide the four basic conditions that we need to compute entropy. But how do we do it? So basically what we have is that at the classical level, if we fix the geometry on the bulk, that automatically fixes uniquely the geometry on the surface because states are continuous. But now we're working with distributional states, distributional quantum states, and then fixing completely the geometry of the bulk doesn't fix anymore uniquely the geometry on the horizon. So we have some degrees of freedom intrinsic to the horizon, and those are the ones that we consider as giving rise to the entropy of the horizon, right? So that is our goal. If we want to compute the entropy of a black hole, we have to count those degrees of freedom intrinsic to the horizon. So we take this microcanonical approach, we fix the value of the area of the horizon, and then we consider a small interval around this area and basically count all horizon states that have a value of area within this interval. and the logarithm of this number will give us the entropy of the black hole. But then we face a problem, and the problem is we have just seen area is a property of the bulk state. Area is given by the J labels. J labels are associated with the bulk spin network. We actually want to count states labeled by A labels, which are the ones that describe the horizon field of space. So we basically need to figure out a way to translate the condition on the area to these intrinsic horizon states. And there's a way to do that, and that was done by Domagala and Lewandowski. And it's basically, well, we see that if we are given a list of A's through the boundary condition, we can have a list of M's. And having a list of M's, we have a lower bound for the value of area that that state can have. And it's the one we obtain by assuming this relation, by taking every J, the J at every puncture equal to the absolute value of M. That would be the smaller area that could be associated to that state. But from then on, we can always consider bigger and bigger J's and construct states with larger areas. So what we can do is say, like, as long as the lower bound associated to my state is below the area that I'm fixing, and the interval I'm considering is large enough, and by large enough, one is talking about the size of Planck area, basically, then one can always construct a state with taking higher values of J's that will have an area falling within the interval. So basically, this area condition gets translated into an inequality, and one can reformulate the whole combinatorial problem in terms of this thing we have here in this box. So N of A would be the number of all finite arbitrarily long sequences of these half-integer numbers, satisfying these two conditions. And these two conditions are this area inequality that I was talking about. So the lower area bound associated to the state has to be smaller or equal than the area I'm fixing, and also this other condition, which is basically a translation to M labels of the Gauss-Bonnet equivalent theory that theorem that I was talking about before, which is what we call the projection constraint. So once we compute all these numbers, the logarithm of that number of that N of A would give us the entropy. And also, Meissner went ahead and computed the solution to this problem in the asymptotic large area limit, and he obtained this result that we are seeing here, where well, this is the result that we know. We have the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in the first leading term. In order to recover that, we need to fix the value of the emergency parameter that appears there in the denominator to be equal to this gamma c, which is a constant that comes from the solution of the combinatorial problem, and then we have an additional logarithmic correction, etc. So this is the result on the large area limit with some approximations. But now we can go to the next slide, and one can also think what happens if I try to solve this combinatorial problem in an exact way. And that is also what we did some time ago. So one can go and put this combinatorial problem on a computer and ask the computer to compute all possible states satisfying these conditions. And of course, you cannot go to very large areas with this, but you can study microscopic black holes this way. And when we did that, what we found, on the first hand, we found that the results we were getting were compatible with the previous results in the large area limit, in the sense that one can fit the result and see that the value for the predictive Barber emergency parameter is the same as predicted in the large area limit, so everything was well. We were also even able to find to fit this logarithmic correction with a coefficient that was compatible within the precision we could reach with the -1/2 we saw before. But also on top of all this consistency with the asymptotic result, we found a new result, a new effect, which is speed span structure that we can see here. So basically, in the left plot, what I'm plotting there is instead of considering this area inequality that I was putting before, I'm just putting an inequality, and I'm basically then seeing how many new states I'm adding to the ones I already had for each area eigenvalue of the black hole. So that gives me this idea of how the degeneracy of states are is distributed, and I see this very particular structure, which is a band structure with some peaks of degeneracy, which are evenly spaced in areas. So I'm plotting degeneracy against area, and each of these points corresponds to one single area eigenstate on the spectrum. Right. So we found these that was we weren't expecting, and then when we just like adds up all the lower values and considers the full inequality, then one gets the right side plot, which is the entropy. So we find an effective discretization of entropy where we have constant values of entropy and then kind of discrete jumps between them that happen at evenly spaced values of area. So this is a very particular prediction of loop quantum gravity. It is coming from the very particular discrete structure of the whole framework and the things going on, and that is what motivates us to think, well, maybe there is something due to this discrete structure happening on black hole radiation. So we can go to next slide. There is also a question, which is, we have this discrete structure for microscopic black holes. We have nothing of that in the large area limit. Are these two results incompatible, or are they compatible? What's going on here? So in order to answer that question, one needs to find a way of computing things in for higher values of areas, but at the same time, being really careful about keeping all the discrete information of the problem, not making any approximations that will, you know, neglect any of these discrete structures. And we worked also on these for some time, and basically, well, there were many things that you have already heard about. We use techniques related with number theory, with things with Pell's equation, partition problem, solution to the Diophantine equation. And with all these, like, we could use many standard techniques to solve those problems, and that was very convenient to find more efficient ways of dealing with the combinatorial problem. We also use generating functions, and generating functions are a very powerful tool for these kind of things, and basically they were very appropriate in the sense that they allowed us to obtain analytical expressions that we could use as a starting point for considering asymptotic expansions and asymptotic computations. And in particular, there was this last step that was finally performed by Barbero and Villaseñor, and which was basically by taking the distribution generated by one of these generating functions, giving the shape of one single of these peaks of degeneracy in the spectrum, they were able to study how that shape behaves in the asymptotic limit when the area tends to infinity, and they found that this tends to a Gaussian, and this Gaussian has a width that keeps increasing with area. So basically, the result is that when one goes to high enough areas, these peaks are going to keep being broader and broader every time, and they will reach a point where they basically overlap each other, and that's going to wash out this discrete structure. So the result is there is no incompatibility between the large area limit and the lower area limit. There's just a smooth transition between these two regimes. And there's only one caveat to that.
Just a comment, a historical comment. I think you could also quote Hanno Salman in this item generating functions, because as far as I remember, it was him who came up with the with this general idea of using generating functions.
Yeah, that's
for the entropy.
That is right. He had a previous work in which he first introduced generating functions, and he attempted to use them to solve these kind of problems. So you're absolutely right. So we can go to next slide then.
Can we just go back to the last slide? I had a question at the bottom. Two questions, actually. The first is that the very last sentence says that, however, not possible. That is, it was not possible for Barbero and Villasenor to rule out a revival of the effect in the asymptotic limit. That is just a statement about the techniques that they were using or something. I mean, or is there... Does anybody consider this a serious possibility, or is it just that, well, mathematically rigorously we can't rule it out?
It's mathematically rigorously we cannot rule it out. It's a very technical detail related to the mathematical techniques they were using. I don't think, and we don't think in general, that it's a very strong possibility that that will happen.
Okay. And the second question is really, what is the relation between this paper that Barbero and Villasenor wrote, and then there was another one, which I think came later, by Barrow and Cao. I mean, it seemed very similar to non-experts, again, doing accounting and trying to say that this step phenomena might disappear. Do you know what the relation is between the two papers?
I don't know the exact relation, but maybe Barro can answer if he's listening.
Well, basically, they are very, very... This is Aurélien Barro. Basically, they are very close. We don't use exactly the same assumptions. We were not also able to prove completely rigorously that there is no revival, but basically, the approach is very similar. In addition, the Monte Carlo simulation that were performed up to 500 Planck areas also confirms that it is a dump.
Okay, but, I mean, I just looked at it briefly, but it seemed to me that the Barbero and Villasenor were taking into account this constraint on the M, summation of M equal to zero, but you were not. Is that correct, or am I wrong about that?
We did not also.
No, but they did, I thought.
Yes, they did and we did not. Yes, it is correct, I think.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, so yeah, that is the thing I had forgot to say. Like, they couldn't rule out a possible revival of this effect, but yeah, that was, as I was saying, a very technical detail. It had to do with the fact that the model they constructed in order to simulate how these... So they basically studied one single peak, and they studied how this peak evolves with when you go to larger limits, but then they constructed a model basically by adding all these consecutive Gaussians and then constructing the whole spectrum. And when you do that and you compare that with the actual spectrum, there's a slight difference. So the model doesn't reproduce exactly the real entropy, but that difference means basically an asymptotic separation between both things when one goes to the large error limit. So basically, when you go to very large error limits, this model is not a good approximation to the real entropy anymore. The thing is, within the range, well within the range where this model was very good still, it was possible to see that the steps completely disappear. So that is confirmed in a regime where this model was a very good approximation. But then eventually this model would stop being a good approximation, and then it cannot tell us anything about what's going to be happening. So therefore, we don't know what weird structures can go on there, and something could happen. But it's not that there is a strong evidence that that is actually going to happen. It looks as it is not going to happen. Anyway, we can go to the next slide. And now we go to the new part, which is basically we want to study radiation. We want to see how these black holes evaporating, and then we want to try to see whether there's any any signal. But now, since we want to do spectroscopy, we want to consider transitions between these different states of the black hole, we don't want to have this interval we had before for computing the area. We need to know the exact degeneracy associated to each single area eigenvalue. And this is slightly different from what we were computing before. And the reason is we cannot use this inequality anymore, because as we saw, the equality was what allowed us, I mean, the interval was what allowed us to use this inequality, basically by saying that if the interval is large enough, then we are always sure that one of these larger area states will fall within the interval. Now we cannot use that anymore. We have to go and make sure that there is actually a configuration of j's, taking j's larger or equal than the m's that we have, that reproduces the exact area eigenvalue we're fixing. So these require to do a new kind of computation, and we did that. And well, you can see the result here. So this result basically is plotting the degeneracy of every single area eigenvalue on the spectrum. Each of these points is one, corresponds to one eigenvalue, and it's the associated degeneracy. So we see that when we do that qualitatively, we are getting basically the same thing that we were getting before with this band structure. But this is not this exact same thing. This is also considering lower, a larger set of eigenstates, which consider, you know, states that have lower area bounds with a, corresponding to a lower value of area, but they can be compatible with the given eigenvalue by constructing a precise configuration of j's that gives the correct value. So this is actually the set of data we are using to compute our spectroscopy thing. So we can go to next slide. And so we want to study Hawking radiation, and well, we know that isolated horizons are not dynamical states. So when we say we're going to be studying Hawking radiation, we don't mean we're going to study the dynamics of the process by which the black holes evaporate. We're just going to take this spectroscopic approach, and basically what we do is consider transitions between different stationary states that are given by this model. And then we can follow this philosophy of Fermi's golden rule and consider that the probability of each transition is going to be proportional to the degeneracy of the states. And, well, that's what we want to do and see what happens. So there are basically two things that one could expect to give a signal on this spectroscopic analysis. The first one is, as we have seen, this particular structure of the degeneracy spectrum, this band structure, the discretization of entropy, all that. Since degeneracy is going to be coming in our computation, well, its particular structure could produce a signal. But even more importantly, and we are going to see that soon, it is the particular structure of the area spectrum itself that can also produce some signals. So what we are going to do is use a Monte Carlo simulation to simulate the evaporation of a black hole and then see what we observe. And in particular, we are looking at three possible signals. One of them are these emission lines. So we are going to study the emission spectrum of a microscopic black hole, and we're going to see these last stages of evaporation, whether there are some particular signals there. We're also going to look at some low energy emission at these last stages of evaporation too. And finally, we will, so these first two signals are related to the area spectrum itself, and the last one will be more related to the particular structure of the degeneracy spectrum. And basically we'll be looking at a larger kind of black holes, see whether there's any signal coming from this structure of the degeneracy spectrum. So we go to next slide.
I have a question.
Yes.
Can we go back to slide number 10?
Yes.
There, in that plot, you are just taking the eigenvalue of area and counted how many states you have for that exact eigenvalue of area. That means, I mean, the difference with respect to the entropy computation is that you are just taking the interval that you were using to compute the entropy to zero. Am I right?
Yes.
But as far as I know, in the case of entropy, there is an additional reason to introduce this interval, and the reason is that when you are quantizing this isolated horizon, there is a pre-quantization condition in the area, so not every value of the area is a good value, and the condition is something like the areas have to be proportional to the level of the Kerr-Simon theory. And the point is that it is not any of these areas which matches exactly with the area spectrum. So you need to introduce that interval in order to have any of these eigenvalues of the area spectrum inside this interval. What is happening with that fact here?
Well,
do you have any idea of?
No, I mean, obviously that is something that we are not taking into account here, but this consideration is in particular tied with the fact that you need to consider a fixed value, a value of the level of the Chern-Simons theory, which is proportional to the area. So that could be potentially a problem to that, but we know now that there are other developments in this computation of entropy, and in particular there are ways of not having to fix the level of the Chern-Simons theory, and then that pre-quantization condition would probably be different and not be a problem for this.
Okay, thank you.
So as I was saying, we want to study basically these lines, these emission lines in the spectrum, and since they come from this very particular shape of the area spectrum in low quantum gravity, well, we expect them to be characteristic of low quantum gravity, and in particular be different if we consider different models or even like non-existing in other models. So in order to check these differences, we're going to look at three different cases. We're going to look at the spectrum produced by low quantum gravity. We're going to also produce a semi-classical Hawking-based model. And we're going to produce another model based on the Bekenstein-Mohanov conjecture. So we use a Monte Carlo simulation to produce these three spectrums, and then we'll try to see their differences. So we can go to next slide. And this is how do we do this? How do we perform this Monte Carlo simulation? So we basically start from a black hole, say area 200 Planck area, and we're gonna modulate the transition probability with a factor given by this thing we see here. So basically, the exponential of the entropy difference. So as we were saying, this transition probability is gonna be proportional to the degeneracy of the final state. And we also introduced this gray body factor here. So then we take this black hole and we let it decay randomly with this Monte Carlo generated code and until it reaches the last final state. So we let it decay all the way and we record the energy of every single jump, every single transition. So we can do that for one black hole, but we can.
Can I ask a question here about the gray body factor? So you just took it from semi-classical analysis, or did you actually look at some loop quantum gravity derivation of a gray body factor, or do you have any indication of some such derivation?
No, I don't think the gray body factor considers any loop quantum gravity derivation, but anyway, Aurelien, that is there, knows much better how this thing works, so he can give you more details.
Yes, indeed, in the current analysis, we use the standard gravity factor, but it's very easy to check that it is a completely subdominant effect. So unless something extraordinary, dramatic happens in the L2G corrections, I don't expect this term to play a major role in the analysis.
Okay, thank you.
So we can go ahead and repeat the same process for, let's say, a million black holes, and do the same, record the transitions that each one of them do perform, and then we plot the final result. And what we get is this thing we have here. So we see this kind of almost continuous background thing, but we have these very strong spikes at certain values of energy. So these are the marks we are observing here. And well, when we go ahead and compare, if we go to next slide, or with the Hawking model, for example, then we see the clear difference. So here we're seeing this almost continuous background, which is basically essentially the same that we were seeing before, but there are no spikes. The way we are computing this is basically by taking the maximally conservative approach, in the sense that we are using the exact same body factor for this model too, and we're even like imposing by hand the same minimal value of area in this Hawking case, in order, you know, we're trying basically to eliminate any other possible sources of discrepancy. So we are sure that the difference is only based on the difference between the area spectrums. And yet we get this clear difference. And also we go ahead and do the same for the Bekenstein-Mohanov conjecture, basically having an evenly spaced spectrum, we get once again one also different thing. So here is it, like we are finding basically a very particular signal from low quantum gravity, which are those very strong spikes that we were seeing in the previous slide. But one can still go ahead and ask, is that enough for us to look at a black hole, see how it's evaporating, and tell whether it's behaving as a low quantum gravity black hole or as a semi-classical black hole? So we go to next slide. So there's something I wanted to say before. If we go to next slide, we see this spectroscopic plot. Slide 15. So here we have basically the same information, almost the same information as we had in the first spectrum plot, but this can help us understand where these spikes are coming from. And they are basically coming, as we can see here, from the latest transitions in the evaporation process. So we have here the most probable transitions, which correspond to these, like the first three we see in the left, are basically all of them transitions, the first three or four we see in the left, transitions from the very last stage to the fundamental state, to the lower state. And these are the ones that happen most often, and these are the ones that correspond to the lines we are observing in the spectrum. Basically what is happening here is that when the black hole approaches the last stage of evaporation, we are considering this whole bunch of black holes doing the same thing, almost all of them, or well, 2% of them, but a very high proportion of them, ends up falling in one of these lower states, and from there going to the base state. So this transition happens the most often, and this is what produces these lines on the spectrum. So we are seeing here that the cause of this signal is in the area spectrum itself. It doesn't have so much to do with the particular degeneracy spectrum that we have. It's more a consequence of the area spectrum. All right, so we can now go now to the next slide and go to the question I was asking before. We want to know whether one can tell the difference between these two spectrums on an experiment. And in order to determine that, one can run this statistical test. It's called the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, which basically measures the...
Question?
Yes?
Yes. Can we conclude from what you just said that if you looked at a single black hole in time rather than a statistical distribution of black holes averaged over time, until the last few photons, it wouldn't be possible to distinguish the loop quantum gravity evaporating black hole from the Hawking evaporating black hole.
Well, that would be a different case in the sense that we wouldn't be seeing this continuous spectrum here. We're considering very small black holes, only the last stages of evaporation. So if we just look at a single one, we're going to basically see just a discrete set of particles emitted with certain energies. So there won't be any of these continuous things if we just look at one.
So roughly, as you go from 100 Planck masses down to one Planck mass, how many photons are typically involved in that transition going down the last 100 Planck masses?
I don't know right now how many photons, but that should be something easy to compute.
Okay, but your aim is to distinguish the different hypotheses about black hole structure by looking statistically at if you had a statistical sample of black hole evaporations rather than making a determination from just a single evaporating black hole.
That is right. That is precisely what I was going to show now in this plot. That is what I'm showing here. We are looking at a sample of black holes that are evaporating, and we are recording what the particles we're getting from them, and we are basically seeing how many of them do we need to observe in order to have enough statistical significance to tell the difference between, like, to say whether the things we are receiving from the black holes observing corresponds to one of the cases or the other. That's what this plot means. So, that's what I was saying. We can run this test and basically see. So let's say we are looking at black holes. They are evaporating. They are sending us particles of certain energies, and we are recording the energy of these particles. And we are, with a certain relative error, we are determining this energy of the received particles. So then we plot here this difference. Basically, the different colors correspond to the significance. So these are the sigmas, up to 5 sigmas we're seeing here on the red. And we are plotting the number, how many black holes do we need to observe as a function of the relative error and the sigma we want to reach. And that is basically...
Okay, but just one last question and then go on. So to do this discrimination test, you're comparing the spectra averaged over time over the last 100 Planck masses, and you're not attempting a discrimination by the structure and time.
No, exactly.
Okay, thank you.
So can you tell us what you mean by relative error and confidence level? What relative error and what?
On the determination of the energy of the particle you're observing. So the black hole emits a particle, you have a detector. The detector tells you the energy of that particle with a certain error. And the sigma is the confidence level which you can tell whether you're observing the loop quantum gravity spectrum or the Hawking spectrum.
So in the plot, the relative error is on x-axis. Where is sigma?
Sigma is the color scale.
Oh, the color scale, I see. So what am I supposed to, can you tell us what the interpretation is if
so
I have...
So basically, let's say I want to go to 5 sigma, so I choose this orange-red color.
Okay.
Then I go to this central region of the plot where I can see, in order to reach 5 sigma, I need to have, I get a relationship between the error and the number of black holes I need to observe. So basically, for a small enough relative error or a large enough number of black holes, I can reach this 5 sigma determination.
The question that Dee was asking again. I mean, so what this is all, what are we doing? We're observing each black hole for
as it decays from some, I don't know, 100 Planck length squared to zero, to almost zero Planck length squared, is that what we're doing? I mean,
yes.
And then we're integrating it out?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So, yeah, this is a result, basically, that if we are able to observe a large enough amount of black holes, or we are able to determine the energy with a very small enough error, then we'll be able to confidently tell the difference between whether we are observing a Lu quantum gravity black hole or a Hawking, or a black hole behaving as a semi-classical Hawking black hole. So we can go to next slide two, and actually we can do the same. This is exactly the same thing, but comparing between Lu quantum gravity and the Muhanov case. And here we can see that it's even easier to tell the difference, and the reason is because in the other case we had spikes against no spikes. Here we have spikes in both of them, but they are placed in different places, so it's even easier to tell the difference. But so we can go to next slide now. And this is the second of the signatures I wanted to talk about, and it's basically these low energy emissions. So what we have is, in the semi-classical case, we know that we start with low temperatures and low energy emission, but when we approach the last stages, then the energy goes up, and then the temperature of the emission goes up. But then when we approach the very final end, there's a kind of a natural cutoff there, because basically the black hole cannot emit more energy than it has left. So there's a characteristic low energy emission associated with these very last stages of the evaporation, and that can be differentiated with this other low energy emission corresponding to lower temperatures. So this is characteristic of the semi-classical process. In Lu quantum gravity, we obviously don't have this, because it is precisely in these last stages when the highest energy jumps are basically produced, and this is given by the discreteness of the air spectrum, so we cannot have low energy emission at this last stage. So this is a characteristic signal also, and this can be checked, and well, we looked at it, and it can be seen on our simulations that is the case. So this is another characteristic feature that could be used to differentiate. And we can go now to the next slide. And this is the third of the things. So now we are looking to, instead of looking to the air spectrum, we're going to look at the band structure in the degeneracy spectrum. We want to see whether there is a signal coming from this. What we need to do now is to observe an instantaneous spectrum. So now we need just one instant of time. And the reason is because we know that this structure in the degeneracy spectrum is evenly spaced in areas. So if there's some signal, we expect it to be proportional to this area spacing. But the relation between this area spacing and the energy is not linear, it's quadratic. So basically, if the mass of the black hole is changing while it's evaporating, the energy associated to this area gap is going to be modified. So what we were doing before, a dynamical process of black hole changing its mass, this effect is going to be completely washed out. We need to look at a sample of black holes that are basically all with the same mass and evaporating in a almost stationary way in order to be able to observe this effect. And the candidates for making such an observation are primordial black holes. So initially there were models for formation of primordial black holes which assumed a continuous mass distribution. If that were the case, we wouldn't be able to observe any of these effects for the same reason. We have all the masses mixed together, so we can observe. But more recent models of primordial black hole production are based on phase transition processes, and they predict a unique initial mass for all of them. So if that is the case, then we have a chance to observe. So, I mean, this prediction is somewhat tricky because it assumes many things, but we can look at it. It's interesting. So if primordial black holes are actually creating these kind of phase transitions and they all have a uniform mass spectrum, and if that mass was larger enough so that they are still there, they didn't all evaporate already. Also, if we can get a strong enough signal in order to be detectable in an effective way, and if we can assume that there is some kind of this discrete effect that I was talking about before, that in the large area limit it will disappear, but well, since there was a little window for a revival, or we can even think in an intermediate regime where there's still some of that happening, if that were the case, then we can go to next slide, and then we would be able to observe something. And well, just making the assumption of all these hypotheses being satisfied, we can run another Monte Carlo simulation and see what would be observed, and this would be the instantaneous spectrum. So we can clearly see these bands coming from the particular band structure in the degeneracy, so that would be one more signal that one could observe. I mean, this one is probably very speculative because it uses many assumptions. But well, it was interesting at least to take a look at this possibility and see whether one can see something, and we actually see this. So we can go to the last slide and conclude. So the conclusion is basically, we know that loop quantum gravity description is somewhat effective in the sense that we are putting the black hole in at the classical level and then we are quantizing the whole thing. And that approach is basically expected to be best suited for the large area regime. One expects it to be a good approximation for large black holes, but one is not sure that this actually has much to do with what will happen in the Planck regime, the deep Planck regime for microscopic black holes. But well, and also, like, we know now that there are different models being currently developed for the study of black hole entropy and black hole description in loop quantum gravity. We have all these SU2 models that include rotation, also some new statistical studies, including the grand canonical ensemble and fixing the number of particles or punctures on the horizon, etc. Also, the thing is going on and it's changing rapidly. However, most of the features, and in particular the first two ones that we studied here, do not depend on the particular black hole model we're using. So it do not depend on the details of this entropy computation, but only on the particular features of the area spectrum in low quantum gravity. And this is a much...
We change time. Yeah. I'm very sorry, they change time. On US, I didn't know.
Is there a question?
He just continue.
All right. So, they're only based on the particular structure of the area spectrum of loop quantum gravity, and this, as we know, is a much better established prediction of loop quantum gravity. So results are stronger than just if they were only based on the particular features of the black hole description, which is something that keeps changing nowadays. And also, on the other hand, we might be far from being able to experimentally detect any kind of Hawking radiation, in particular from microscopic black holes. But who knows? I mean, it's nice speculating that we can actually do that in a not-so-far future. But what we know is that, well, nevertheless, it is highly non-trivial to obtain any observable predictions that could be tested, even in hypothetical experiments. And what we know now is that if these kind of microscopic black holes are sometimes found at LHC or the next generation of accelerators or from cosmic rays or whatever, then they can help us tell whether loop quantum gravity is going on the right track. So, that's everything I wanted to say. Thanks.
Questions?
Okay, can I try one again?
Go ahead.
Hello? Yes, so I'm wondering if there isn't the possibility for tests on the circumstance that we get lucky along the following lines. If you look at your slide, the figure on your slide 1321 with the spectrum you computed for loop quantum gravity, just consider the biggest spike, the one at about 0.16. I suppose that's Planck energies. And supposing that you saw just one evaporating black hole at the very end, but supposing you saw that photon among the handful of photons that you saw in the spectrum of the end of that one black hole, that photon is only probable in a loop quantum gravity scenario, and because there isn't a spike exactly at that point in the Mukhanov spectrum, and there's no spike in the Hawking spectrum, couldn't you then argue with some probability that loop quantum gravity must be right because that's the only case in which that one photon would have been probable?
I mean, yeah, you could argue that. I think it would be a long shot argument, but yeah, in principle.
If that photon, I mean, if that's the biggest spike, that probably corresponds to the transition that has about 2%.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, if you assume that there's roughly 10 photons per black hole, that means you would only have to see something like 4 or 5 black holes to have a good chance of seeing that. And that's a much better situation than having to see thousands of black holes to let a spectrum accumulate.
Yeah, I mean, that could be in a practical situation in which you are able to actually observe these kind of things, that I agree that would be probably the first thing or the simplest thing to go and look at in order to have an idea of how these things are working. Yeah.
Can I
make a comment?
I mean, if there are going to be possible to see thousands of them, we already would have seen one. But it might be that if some new X-ray spectroscopy opens up or something like that. I guess these are extremely high-energy photons. But if some spectroscopy opens up that lets us see photons close to the Planck scale, at OJ or something like that, we would be lucky to see a handful of them.
Someone wanted to say something?
Yes, I fully agree with Lee, but I think I can make a comment.
Yes.
The mean number of photons emitted from 200 Planck area to zero is about 5 or 6 per black hole, which is very small. Of course, if you have an infinite energy resolution, even one black hole can be enough to conclude. But in real life, you have to take into account the energy, the error on the energy associated with the detection. And if you add up a realistic error, then the number of required black holes increases dramatically, and you need thousands of black holes to conclude. Just because if you smear the line with a 10% error, you don't see the line at all anymore. So really, the number is an issue, and you cannot conclude with a few black holes. I think it's completely impossible.
So I understand right. I mean, these photons in these spectra are Planck energy, and if we saw them, we would see one hitting the upper atmosphere and lighting up OJ or something like that. We're not going to see these in a gamma ray detector or a TUV detector.
Well, with current technologies, I think nobody has ever tried to detect a Planck energy photon, so I don't know what would be the techniques and I don't know what would be the errors. But if I extrapolate from the uncertainties associated with contemporary calorie measures, I don't see any hope for an error smaller than, say, 10%.
No, I appreciate that. But just one point. If a Planck energy photon hit the atmosphere above OJ, OJ would see it. So it's not quite true that there's been no possibility of detecting them. OJ would light
yes,
up.
OJ would see it, definitely. OJ would see it easily.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Abhay. So there's one point that is quite important, I think, which is this is something that is some Kirill Krasnov and I had a very early paper, I think 98 or something, in which we had this similar kind of calculation. Of course, not anywhere, no numerics and nothing, all the important features that you have, they were, of course, completely absent. But one of the things was that that analysis brought out very clearly was that if I look at, say, atomic physics, and if I just looked at energy levels, and I say just use this A and B coefficients, I will get some spectrum, such as the one that you are calculating for black holes. But in atomic physics, there are also selection rules. That is to say, there is actually a Hamiltonian, which causes this transition. And sometimes, you know, some transition may be very, very likely, but this Hamiltonian completely kills it. And so this, I think one of the important things that is, I'm not saying this as a criticism, but just as a caution, is that there are selection rules which might rule out, you know, a whole bunch of lines we don't know yet, because we don't have good control on what the interaction Hamiltonian is that is actually carrying out, that is going to be responsible for these transitions. I mean, it is something now that you have such details. I mean, at that time, we did not have any details at all, so there was no real motivation to look for the various interaction Hamiltonians. But that is something that one should now perhaps start looking at.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, absolutely, yeah.
I also have a question about, again, this slide 13 that you have with these lines. I am a little confused about why there's a line which is, what is being plotted on the y-axis, the intensity or something, is it? Or?
It is the number of particles received at that energy.
Right. So why is it, I mean, can one understand, for example, just the number of particles received at, you know, the third line are much, much larger than the number of particles received at the first two lines or something? I mean, is there some...
Yeah, because...
Then again, it goes off. I mean, what is peculiar about that particular line?
Because out of the million black holes we are evaporating, 20,000 of them are jumping at this, are performing this transition corresponding to the third of the lines, and only 10,000 of them are doing the other two. And you can see that in the other, in the bigger spectroscopic plot that I was showing. Basically, you have the same energy there. You have one transition with almost a 2% probability, and then the next ones are around 1%, I believe. And you can go to slide 15, and you can see there the first three transitions on the left correspond to these three lines you were talking about, I think.
Okay. Again, so in this case, we should be able to understand it in terms of degeneracies, right, of the levels.
Uh-huh.
So, I see. So you're saying that one is not degenerate, is non-degenerate, and the other ones have some degeneracies, and I understand that. And what is this transition is going, the bottom level arrow, up to what level is it going? Is it going from
to the
level to minimum area? Or
to minimum area, yeah.
Thanks very much.
More questions?
I have another question. I want to know your opinion about the following. You are trying to get information looking at the last stages of evaporation of a black hole, where black holes are extremely dynamical, and the model from the very beginning is using an isolated horizon, which is isolated, there is no dynamics. What do you think is the uncertainty that you are introducing by considering isolated horizons for this kind of black holes?
Well, I was commenting that on the conclusions. Basically, we don't expect these models to be a very good approximation of the real quantum black hole in this deep Planck regime. But as I was saying also in the conclusions, these features that we're talking about here do not depend so much on the particular model you're choosing. They basically depend on the error spectrum of the quantum gravity, and that has nothing to do with the particular model or the isolated horizons we are considering. It's just the error spectrum of the whole theory. So as far as these kind of considerations are concerned, I don't think that is a big issue.
Okay,
now and also in the talk that it does not really depend too much on the models and so on. But, I mean, it's not really just the, I mean, you need the, a certain value of the emergency parameter, right? Barbary emergency parameter in order to get the actual numbers and frequencies and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and the different kind of ideas have led to different values of Barbary emergency parameter. So that part, I think it does depend on a model. Namely, you choose some value of Barbary emergency parameter.
But if you fix a different value of the Barbary emergency parameter, you would have basically the same structure of the spectrum, just shifted in energies, right?
Yeah, I agree. But I mean, this is like, that's why I did not bring this point up before. But, you know, if you look at what, as Lee was pointing out, that if you measure some energy at a given, see a spectral line somewhere, then can we not conclude something? So for individual spectral lines, there is actually a model dependence.
Yeah.
For the general structure of the lines, spectral lines, there is, it's not model dependent, but
yeah.
I want to introduce something else, because Abhay's mentioning basically the difference between model in this kind of counting. So if you are using an SU2 group to model the horizon or a U1, but my question was basically about isolated horizons, because so beyond that SU1, SU2 on the U1. Because in these isolated horizon models, you are using them to relate what are the states of the quantum states of the horizon with the area operator. This relation between quantum states on the horizon in the Chesheimer theory and the area operator on the bulk comes from this model. And we don't know if dynamical horizons are going to give us the same relation or something similar. So this is the point that I was trying to raise.
Yeah, I mean, this is a point to consider, of course, if one wants to study the full dynamical situation, and that is right. I was saying also earlier, like, we are basically considering only these stationary states and transitions between them. And in some sense, yeah, we're assuming that these stationary states are a good approximation to the states that are actually going to happen in this process.
Thank you.
There is another model of quantum black hole, which is in which another area operator is used. Instead of this loop quantum gravity, this original area operator, we use the flux operator to define area. And in that case, this everything is much simpler. So if your calculations are repeated in this simpler case, could you see something a little better?
I mean, if you use a different area spectrum, then all these will change. Obviously, that's what I mean. If this is based in the spectrum, basically. So if you use an evenly spaced,
that's the spectrum where the area is just equally spaced proportional to J.
Yeah. So if you go and
then that's the Bekenstein-Mukhanov case.
Exactly.
I see. But including the degeneracy, so spectrum maybe, this is in the case which I'm talking about, the spectrum itself is equally spaced. However, degeneracy is specific for the loop quantum gravity.
Good point.
Yeah, that would be an intermediate situation between what Lee was saying, the Bekenstein-Mukhanov model we have here, with an additional contribution of considering the particular degeneracy of loop quantum gravity instead of just like the semi-classical one. So we haven't looked at that, but I would guess it would look pretty much more similar to the Bekenstein-Mukhanov one than to this loop quantum gravity one that we have here.
Okay,
thank you. Last question from me. Are you then, I mean, the most likely way that we would see an evaporating black hole, it's all unlikely, but the most likely way astrophysically would seem to be a primordial black hole, which, as you say, is about 10 to the 15 Planck masses radiating in 10 to the 15 grams radiating in the X-ray. If we just saw one of those, is your expectation that the spectrum would be indistinguishable from Hawking, even if we could look at it for a long time? supposing that we just saw, you know, X-ray spectrum from 1 × 10^15 gram black hole, is there any chance of distinguishing it from a Hawking spectrum?
I mean, if you believe that there is these that these band structures survive all the way up to that energy, then I guess you could tell the difference.
No, the 10^15 gram was really supposed to be these black holes would be reaching the end point of their evaporation right now. So
no, I know that, Abhay, but
Hakobo, not you, because Hakobo is answering as though 10^15 grams.
We don't know where they started, so I'm saying supposing it had now 10^15 grams, just to throw out a case, so we wouldn't see the end point. We would see maybe my question is confused, but
there are two questions. I mean, I thought that when, because you said primordial would be, this was great interest, right, just after Hawking's discovery in the late 70s, early 80s, astronomers were actually looking for such primordial black holes. And the whole idea then was that if such black holes were created in the early epoch, whatever, that early epoch in those days was, you know, not in the Planck time or something, but much later than Planck time, but much before the last scattering surface, then they would be completely exploding today. And therefore, they were looking for signatures of such black holes and very last stages of explosion. For that, I think
right. Good. Thanks. You're right. But they were looking not for Planck energy photons from the last few photons, but they were looking for X-rays.
That's right. So they were looking for a burst, because the idea was that at that time, you know, people were thinking of Hagadron models and so on and so forth. So the idea was that there will be a burst of energy coming out, and it will be in X-ray. Right.
So I'm just focusing on that case. So when the temperature is roughly, you know, hundreds of MeV, so it's anyway, I'm getting my numbers all messed up. But in the X-ray or the gamma ray, where we have good detectors and could easily see it, supposing that we really saw one, is there any chance from, there would be many photons, but just one case, is there a chance to see the band structure?
I mean, you would have to consider how stationary you can see that black hole at, and in particular, how much the change of mass is going to be affecting its relation with the area gap, in order to see that, like, whether in this long period of time you're observing, you're actually having a shift in the energy associated to that area gap or not, and if the relation is, and the variation is small enough that it still allows you to see some effect, then you would be able to say something.
Jacobo, can I just comment on this?
Yes.
I fully agree with you. I think to answer Lee's question, the main point is just a question of distance. If this black hole is one parsec away, of course, a single black hole would be enough to distinguish. The problem is that even if you close the universe with, say, 10^15 gram black holes, the amount of black holes per cubic meter is extraordinarily small, so the probability for the black hole to be small enough so that a single black hole is enough is very small.
Understood. Okay, thank you.
More questions? Okay, I have a comment. Astrophysicists Bernard Carr and Jane McGibbon have turned the argument around and constrained the number of primordial black holes by looking at the gamma ray background. Presumably those constraints should now be revised in light of loop quantum gravity, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Jacob again.